Get out of here. There you go.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Alan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
And I've been sober all day. And he kind of promised me that this don't go to Obama. You know? they know enough about me already. I had my last drink on March the 4th, 1964. And I came to AA March the 8th after I stopped shaking. You know? Just to give you a little synopsis of what I was like, or what it was like. I was the youngest of three kids, born in New York. at least I thought I was the smartest, the best looking, and everything else in the family, but I don't know. Other people had other opinions. But up until sixth grade, I was, when my mother would go to the PTA meetings, the nuns would say, "Alan is a good little boy." After sixth grade, they never said that again. It just so happens that in the summer vacation of the sixth grade, I started drinking whiskey. And it was like an instant change. I became an animal right off the bat. I didn't like it. I drank a pint of whiskey in a guy's house. I threw up. I blacked out. I did everything. When I went down, it came back up. My nose and my eyes were running. It was terrible. The worst shit I ever drank in my life. But for some reason, I wanted it again. I was sick for the whole week. I was throwing up with dry heaves and every other damn thing. And the next Saturday night, he invited me over again, and I said, "Yeah, okay." And I had already had a plan. This time, I ain't gonna drink like I did last time. It's gonna be different. I'm gonna drink less. I'm gonna drink slower. I don't remember maybe a half an hour of the drinking. I blacked out almost immediately. I don't know how I got home. It was only across the street, but how I ever got in the house without my mother killing me. And nothing was ever said. And I threw up for a week, and she never questioned it. My mother hated drunks. And I found out the reason why she never questioned me is because she didn't want to admit that I was like my father. You know, she started telling me, "You're just like your father." And that was my cop-out. I remember one time I got drunk and my father was going to, you know, smack me around a little bit. And she says, "Don't you touch him. The example you set, what do you expect from him?" So now it wasn't my fault that I was no good. It was his fault, you know. And I was instantly screwed up. I was 11 years old. When I was 12, I got thrown out of the Boy Scouts for drinking, for stealing wine out of the liquor store in uniform. And I learned how to lie, steal, cheat, and do everything else in that year. And I swore I was being framed. And the Boy Scout meeting was on Thursday. We were in Troop 26. It was on my arm. And I was the only one missing from the meeting that night, but I swore they set me up. I was framed. I didn't steal a wine, you know? I remember running away from the liquor store. And the reason it was wine was because the door was open. It was summertime, and you know, they didn't have air conditioning. And the guy was sitting in the chair, so the wine was right by the door, so I grabbed it and ran. And he almost caught me. He came after me, and he almost caught me. And I thought about next time. So my scheming brain started working. Next time I grab two bottles. This way here I can hit him with one, you know, if he catches me. You know? I became an instant animal. And graduated from grade school with the nuns, and I wanted to be an engineer. That was my big dream. I had a grandfather that was a builder, and he was going to back me with college and everything else. By the time I graduated from grade school, I didn't want to be an engineer anymore. I wanted to be a prize fighter, you know? That made more sense. It was easier money. I didn't have to go to school. And so I got into boxing. I also got into wanting to be a gangster. I hung around some bookies that were in this bar that my father hung out in. I got to know them pretty good. Before you know, by the time I was 13, they were serving me in that bar. They weren't too fussy in them days. The bartender told me, "As long as you got proof of age, I'll serve you. I don't care whose it is, just that covers me, you know?" So that was the way it was. So anyway, just to cut all the little crap out, I got into high school, and I got thrown out of Brooklyn Tech the first term. They decided that maybe I was the travel from, I lived in Queens County, and Brooklyn was another county, and I had to take two buses and a subway to get there. And maybe the traveling was too much for me. So they talked my mother into pulling me out. They didn't throw me out. I didn't pass one subject, but they, because of my past record, they gave me credit for every subject. So I went to local high school, where I wanted to go, and I got in with a so-called bad crowd, you know. And it's funny, that bad crowd, they weren't allowed to hang around with me either, you know. So I you know, their parents thought I was the part of the bad crowd. But anyway, we used to do things like steal, you know. We only stole stuff that started with A, like a bottle of whiskey, a wallet, a car, you know, things like that. So we used to kick in liquor store windows and grab bottles and run. We used to break into grocery stores for beer, cigarettes, and I got jammed with a stolen car, and I got arrested for it, and I had to go to court back and forth. Just got off the rap. They gave me a break, and I got off clean, and I got arrested again for a burglary. I went before the same judge, and I had a good record before that, you know, so he decided he was going to keep me in jail. He wouldn't let my mother bond me out until the trial came up because maybe I'd learn something. So he put me in this jail in Brooklyn called Raymond Street Jail. It's gone now. That jail was so bad. I don't think there was ever another prison except in the dark ages that was as bad as that. Where they mixed the kids in with, you know, there was people that were waiting for trial like me, kids, and it was old timers that were doing time there, and they mixed us all together, you know. And I had some guy that thought I was kind of cute, you know. He wanted me to be his jailhouse bride, and I went in there real tough, giving everybody a bad time. And one night the guard says to me, if you don't wise up and start treating us with respect, we're going to put Charlie in the cell with you. So I became a model prisoner instantly. And I sweated it out every time I was watching my back. Every time I, you know, seen somebody come up, I thought it was Charlie. So finally, he got shipped out to Attica. But when I got out, I was there about 5 weeks, I think. 5 weeks or 7 weeks, I don't remember now. But when I got out, I said a little prayer to God. I said, God, I'll never do another thing like that again that'll put me in that position, you know. And about a month later, I robbed a guy. You know, I beat him up and stole his wallet, me and a couple of other guys. And I couldn't believe it. I was so afraid of jail, prison. And yet I kept doing things that was going to put me there. And I didn't get caught for that one. It's a good thing. I would have got about 10 years for that one. But anyway, I met this girl. I wanted to get married. I was 17 years old. I wanted to get married. You know, and in fact, she was the only girl that could tolerate me. You know, I used to take her on these one-way dates. I'd take her out, and somebody else would have to take her home because I'd get drunk. You know, and and she was a good woman. She was a good girl. I ended up marrying her 3 years later. I was starting to feel like I was going to lose her, so the Korean War broke out, and I said, I'm going to join the army. I told her that's why I'm so screwed up, because I got that axe hanging over my head. I'm going to get drafted. I'm going to go to Korea. And I got to get that over with. So I enlisted in the army. She thought it'd be a great idea. I thought she'd say, no, don't do that, you know. And I also thought I had the ace in the hole, my mother. She would never let me go in the army. She thought it'd be a great idea, too. So I went in the army. And hopefully, I was thinking that maybe I didn't realize I needed to grow up, but I didn't realize that, because I thought I was way ahead of, you know, people my age. I got in the army in basic training. It was over the Christmas holidays, and they said half the company can have Christmas and the other half can have New Year's, and everybody wanted New Year's because of the parties. I said, I'll take Christmas, and it was a surprise because I was one of the biggest drinkers there, and I had the attitude. I took Christmas and I stayed able for New Year's. You know, I got them both. You know, if I took New Year's, I couldn't have got Christmas. So, and my thinking was like this: what the hell are they going to do to me? Put me in the army? I'm in the army. They're going to send me to Korea? I'm going to Korea. You know, so I figured I was untouchable. They couldn't do that to me. Well, I didn't go to Korea. They sent me to school. You know, and they were going to teach me Morse code. I spent I think it was 15-week course or something like that. I said, nobody flunks out. It took me 51 weeks to flunk out of that course, and I flunked out. I was AWOL constantly. I did self-will run riot. The Army didn't change me at all. When I wanted to go home, I went home. They catch me, they put me on restriction to the post. I go home the next weekend while I'm restricted. I lived a charmed life. I never got court-martialed. I never got busted. I went home one time for Thanksgiving dinner. I came back shortly before New Year's, you know? And I wasn't missed. That's how important I was, you know? I was in a reception center waiting for orders, and I had buck slips. I wrote the sick book, and I couldn't pull KP. I couldn't pull guard duty. I had a friendly doctor. And so they never missed me. I got back... I didn't know anybody in the barracks. They all shipped out, you know. And I thought, oh, man, I'm in trouble. So I found one guy in one of the barracks that I knew. And I said, well, you know, I woke him up. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning when I got there. And I said, what's happened? You hear anything? He said, hear anything about what? I said, about me. Nah, I didn't hear nothing. Well, next morning, I fall out for reveille, and my first name called out was me, you know. So I report to the orderly room. I go in and I think I'm done. I already kissed my mother goodbye, my girlfriend goodbye. I'm going to do at least 6 months, you know, in the stockade. Anyway, they call my name. I go in the orderly room and they said, where the hell were you for the last formation yesterday? I said, geez, Sarge, I don't know. I might have been in the service club or something, you know. So he said, you're damn lucky. He said, you're shipping out. Your orders are in. I'll have you court-martialed. So, again, they give me 10-day delay in road to get from... Fort Devens, Massachusetts to Arlington, Virginia. And I remember saying, shit, I could walk there in 10 days, you know? It took me 14 days to get there, because I got there 4 days AWOL. And that was the only thing I got punished for. I had to make up 8 days when I got out of the service for the 4 days that I was AWOL. That was the only thing I ever got caught for. I don't know. God had plans for me. They made me a security guard of all things, and top secret, and I had to be cleared for all this crap. And I was the worst, you know, worst person to trust with top secrets. I'd tell anybody anything, you know, and I would be like Snowden now. And so it was a spit and polish outfit, second only to the honor guard that walked around the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And the shoes was shining like, you know, like the sun, and polished brass, and you know, sharp uniforms. And I didn't belong in that either, because I was the biggest slob they ever saw. I was there 2 years, almost 2 years as a security guard. I never had my uniform cleaned. Never once. I used to iron it. And the friggin' thing would stand up in the corner by itself. I never had any money to do anything, you know? I used to steal underwear, you know? And the day after payday, I was broke. I owed half of it, and the other half I spent drinking. And here I'm saving to get married. That's what I was supposed to be saving for. You. I sent a bond a month came out of my pay, $18.75. And as soon as I get home the next weekend, we'd cash the bond and blow the $18.75. I never had nothing. So anyway, I got married, had a year to go. I found out that they wouldn't ship me out with less than a year to go. So we got married, and I showed that girl poverty she never thought possible, you know. I'll tell you, she thought I was going to change. I thought I was going to change, and I was serious. I mean, I was crazy about her, and I really wanted to do the best I could for her. We lived off post. After we got married, we showed up at the, you know, at our apartment. I had to go to work the next day, and I worked shift work, you know, midnight shift and 4 to 12. And I went on the 4 to 12 shift, and I said, I'll see you around midnight. I got home about 11 o'clock in the morning, you know. I started right off the way I was to be the rest of my life. Unreliable, drunk, every chance I could get. I had the excuse, oh, the guys were good, happy to see me, they wished me the best, they all had some wine, and so I drank, and I said I fell asleep. I didn't fall asleep, I was running around like a maniac. But that was the way we lived. We lived payday to payday. And some paydays I got home with $15, you know. And when I got out of the service, she was pregnant. I got out my 8 days late. I got out in November. and that's what's got out in October. And my son was born a month later, and we stayed in Virginia because I had no money saved, naturally, so she had the baby in Fort Belvoir Hospital because it was service-connected pregnancy. You know, that's what they said, it was service-connected because I was in the Army. So she had the baby, and I got a job in the local plumbing shop across the street. I didn't mention how I got into the plumbing trade. One of the times I got arrested, I was not going to school. Not working, just hanging around doing nothing. And the lawyer told my mother, you better get that kid either back in school or get him a job because this judge is going to throw the book at him, you know? So my brother-in-law's brother got me a job as a plumber's helper. And my mother laughed. She said, because I was a prima donna, that's dirty work. She says, you'll never last at that. And she thought about it. She said, maybe you would. She said, you spend so much time with your head in the toilet bowl that you'd probably be good at it. You know? And I ended up on the plumber. And a damn good one, believe it or not. It was a gift from God because I didn't do anything to learn the trade, but I was just good at it. I learned from a guy that was the best plumber in the shop, but he was a drunk. He was the lowest paid, and he was a drunk. And everybody said he was the best plumber. His name was Duffy. And that's where I ended up. By the time I got into AA, I was the best plumber in the shop, and I was the lowest paid because I was the most unreliable. We lost the house that I bought on a GI Bill. It was $75 a month. I couldn't manage the payments. So some real estate guy wanted to buy my mortgage from me because of GI mortgages. They could sell the house with the mortgage, and it was a good deal for somebody. So he bought my mortgage. He got me arranged with another house that I could buy. I was in a good neighborhood. I went to a Tobacco Road neighborhood, and my mortgage payment was only $143 a month. I couldn't pay the $75. I know I could pay the $143. That's the way. I don't know. I was not living in reality. I never lived in reality. Well, we hung around there. It was in Central Islip, Long Island, two blocks from the Nut House. And the neighbors that lived there, most of them worked there, or they were on welfare. And they go through the Nut House gates to get to the main street, I would never go through it. I wouldn't go near that Nut House. I was afraid the net would come down. I thought there was something wrong with me. I knew there was something wrong with me, but I never thought it was alcohol. I was drunk all the time, but I never thought it was alcohol. In fact, I was, like I heard said so many times, I was the last one to know that I had a problem with booze. I knew I had a lot of problems, and I thought I drank because of them, And it turned out I had the problems because I drank, Anyway, I got my license somehow as a plumber, and then I decided I was going to go in business for myself because I was unemployable, really. So I bought a truck off an old boss of mine that had been broadsided. The whole side was caved in. And I had my name put on the other side. And I used to park it in front of Huey's Bar with the good side out, and I waited to be discovered, I wasn't discovered too often. I was the poorest guy in the neighborhood. I had the master plumber's license, and the other people were on welfare, and they had more than I did, So it went on like this, and actually it progressed, it got worse. I started going on benders. I used to drink weekends, then the weekends started overlapping each other, and then I go on benders. I go to work on Monday and come back on Friday. I remember one night I came home and my wife says, it's got to be more than just, I always told her, I was just out with the guys, having a few drinks. And the conversation was so interesting, I couldn't leave, So I come home after a week and she says, got to be more than just booze. She says, there's got to be a woman out there. And she took another look at me. She said, no, there's no woman. I didn't have no teeth. I was sleeping in the car. I'm a plumber. I do dirty work. I stunk to high heaven. And so she never accused me of being. And I used to say, at least I'm faithful. I wasn't faithful. I couldn't have made out in a woman's prison with a pocket full of pardons, Anyway, it went from bad to worse. And I mean, I drank. I preferred Canadian Club, but I drank anything. I drank rubber and alcohol when I was in the service. I drank wine. I drank. I ended up mostly on beer because that's all I used to call it. Beer was 15 cents in the bar, And they buy back every third drink, you know? You'd buy two and a bartender, you'd buy your third one. So for a dollar, that was entrance fee, I used to call it. For $1, I could get 9 beers, you know? And by that time, if I really played it slow, drank it slow, somebody would come in that would lend me another dollar, you know? And that's how I supported myself. I'd go in there with the whole world on my shoulders. I'd taken my house away and this and that. And as soon as that door closed behind me, everything was fine, you know? And I blacked out. I was a little bit crazy in some of the things I did. I hated cheap people. You know, that was one of my pet peeves. So when I walked into AA, I knew there wasn't going to be no Jews in here because Jews were too cheap. My father used to tell me that. They were too cheap to drink. But the guy I met, one of the guys I met was my best friend, became my best friend. He's my friend for the whole 50 years, 49 years I'm in here. His name was Shapiro. And I thought he was Italian. The funny thing was, so did he. You know? I found out he wasn't when he said, my mother told me nice Jewish boys don't drink like you, so I became an Italian. You know? And he was as crazy as I was. And he's over in Largo now. And anyway, my life was a La La Land. It was a total disaster. I had a boss that... who was an alky, one shop I worked for. See, what happened, I worked for shops, and I never got fired. That's why I know I was good, because they'd never fire me. They just keep, you know, covering for me. And so, but then I got so unreliable that they said, look, we'll subcontract work to you. We'll give you a set price to do the job, and what it takes you a day or a week, you know, you get the same money. Okay, so that was fine. So being an alky, an overachiever. I wouldn't drink when I worked. That's why they never fought. None of the bosses knew I was a drunk, because I just didn't drink when I worked. I drink after work and I show up the next day, but I wouldn't drink when I worked. And I was very proud of the work I did. So anyway, where the hell was I? Oh, they started subcontracting work for me. So being the overachiever that I was, I had a job that paid $180. I was only making $140 a week at the time. This was in the early 50s, mid 50s. And so I said, hell, man, that's good money. I did the job in one day, you know. I got to people's house around 7:30 in the morning. They had to throw me out at 11 o'clock at night. I wouldn't quit. I kept working. And the woman kept saying, boy, you're some worker. I'm feeling great, you know. I didn't work again for a week, you know. I made my week's pay, you know, and I didn't get home either with the money. I was sitting in a bar one time. They gave me a helper. I was in business like that, lumping. Then I'd get a job someplace, and then I, you know, quit that and then start subbing again. I kept thinking I was in business, you know. And all I had was, I had a truck and a license. I had no business. I had no credit. When I had the truck parked in front of Yui's bar, the only people that called me were my creditors. I had credit then. They see the phone number on there, and they call them, they remind them, said they call me. So I had my number changed. I had it unlisted. My business number. That's a hell of a good way to run a business, right? So that's the way I worked. And I remember one time I drank during the day. I went in early again, and I was going to knock the job out in one day. And I got very hungry at lunchtime. So I said, I'm going to go out and get a sandwich. I'll be right back. In the meantime, I cut the sewer line. I cut the water lines, drained them down, drained the boiler, and I never came back. You know? And the boss still didn't know what was wrong with me. He said he thought I was very sickly. You know? Anyway, I went to work for this one shop, and they gave me a helper by the name of Roy. And Roy was just what every drunken plumber needed. Roy was a guy that I'd say, but if I ever got as bad as that son of a bitch, I'd stop drinking, you know? And he became my bosom buddy. We hung around together for about 2 years. I'd quit the job, and I'd take him with me, you know? And when I went in business, he was in business with me. And that even hung on a little bit after I sobered up. But I used to always criticize Roy for the way he drank. He drank so much. And I ran into him after I sobered. I lost track of him for about a year before I got into AA. And I run into him in the supply house after I sobered up, and he says, "Hey, good to see you. Come on, I'll buy you a beer." And I said, "I don't drink anymore, Roy. I joined AA." He says, "Christ, it's about time." He never joined, but I did. But that's when I was really hitting bottom, because I know I hit bottom, because I couldn't get. I was afraid to go home. I dream up all these things. She's got guys waiting for me to beat me up and shit like that. I was nuts. And I decked some poor guy from Beneficial Finance, because I came home one night and I heard a car door slam, and this guy came running up the alleyway after me, and I hit him. You know, I thought it was somebody that she was gonna have me beat up. And I said, "Christ, what are you, crazy?" You know, and he said, I want to talk to you about your loan from Beneficial Finance." So I come into AA, and I know I was in the right place. There was a guy in my group that had a dog that attacked when he said "beneficial." So there was somebody that thought like me. And I came home. This was in March of '64. I came. I left for work in April, and I came home in March, about a week and a half later. And I was in a bar with Roy one. I think it was the weekend before I came into AA. And I'm sitting there at a table with my head on the bar. I slept there. And Roy's got his head on the other side of the table. And the bartender's asleep behind the bar standing up. And a real classy joint. And I hear the door open. I hear the bell ring when the door opens. And I see this gorgeous woman walking in. I say, "Hey, Roy, look at this, look at this, look at this." It was my wife. I didn't even recognize her. You know? She was coming to get my pay. You know? When I did get home, I slept in the car two nights and shook it out, and three nights, and then I came home, and I made sure I got home two or 3 o'clock in the morning when everybody was asleep. I had five kids in the meantime too, which weren't doing so well either, and I used to feel sorry for myself about that. I never felt sorry for her having them, but I had to support them. I mean, that was hell of pressure on me. She let me sleep all day, and then she woke me up and said, "You want a cup of coffee?" And I said, "Yeah." She was talking to me. I expected to get hit with something, you know. And so we sat and had coffee. She said, "I got to talk with you." And I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "You know what's the matter." She said, "I think you're an alcoholic." And I said, "You know, I've been thinking about that too, you know." I wasn't thinking about that. I was agreeing with anything she said. So, of course, she was talking nice, you know. And she asked me if I'd stay with the kids that night, because she had someplace to go. And I didn't question it. I said, "Sure, you know." She trusted me with the kids. I never hurt the kids. And, I mean, physically. She went to Al-Anon, the underground. I didn't know anything about Al-Anon. I didn't know anything about AA. I never heard of it. I heard AA was a bunch of kooky, holy rolling kooks. I also heard it was a bunch of drunks that got together and they didn't know each other's names and they couldn't talk about each other. That's why it was anonymous. I heard all these crazy stories. I had no idea what AA was about. I didn't know it was about stopping drinking. But she told me when she came back that she went to Al-Anon. And I said, "What's that?" And she told me. And she said, "I really think you're an alcoholic." So I said, "All right, this is a Saturday morning now." And she says, "You want help?" And with my warped mind, I said, "Who's going to lend me $10,000? I don't know. It's a drinking money, I guess. I don't know. I owed everybody, but it's nowhere near that amount of money. I didn't have that amount of credit." So she said, "I got a number for you to call." No, she didn't. She says, she told me about AA. I said, "All right, call him." She said, "I wouldn't call him. I ain't calling him. You got to call him." So I said, "All right." She made me look it up in the phone book and everything else. Now, I was living out, Eastern Long Island, and the intergroup at that time was in Manhattan. And the people that answered the phones, there was no service like we have now. The people that answered the phones, most of them were from Brooklyn and Manhattan and places like that, and they didn't know nothing about the island. So it was a woman. She says, I'd like to go to a meeting. She says, "Right now?" I said, "No, not right now. How about Monday?" You know, I didn't want to go there looking like you people. You know, I knew what you were going to look like. Them drunks, them anonymous drunks. So she told me there was a meeting in Sayville, Long Island, and she said, "Do you know where Sayville is?" I said, "Yeah." She says, "It's in St. Francis Church." And I said, okay. And she told me it was 9 o'clock, and that church thing really hit me, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm scheming. I want to go, but, you know, please my wife. I ain't going to get involved in no church, you know. So she wasn't sure where the church was, so she said, look in the news day, in the newspaper, and they have a list of all the different meetings and stuff like that. And, you know, it'll tell you how to get, you know, where it's at. So I spent the next all day Saturday and Sunday and part of Monday taking a shower, shaving. I went on a shopping spree with the $8 I had left, and I bought myself a pair of pants. They were like they were like tissue paper. It was in March. It was cold as hell out. A white T-shirt. I had a pair of sneakers I had, and no socks. That's how I went to my meeting, because I didn't want to look like no goddamn alcoholic, you know? Oh, and I bought a little thin jacket. Yeah, that's right. And so this is where my miracle started. They say stick around till the miracle happens. My miracle happened before I got into AA. I looked in the paper, and there was a meeting in Babylon, and it said 17 Mansfield Place, and I said, that's for me. I ain't going to church. I'll go to this place. I knew where Mansfield Place was. I knew people who lived all their life in Babylon didn't know where Mansfield Place was, but I knew where it was. I woke up one morning about 3 or 4 weeks before this time, and I was in front of a diner. I had no idea where I was. I got out of the car, and I looked, and there was a sign up there, and it said Mansfield Place. That's how I knew where Mansfield Place was. And so I went to my first meeting there. I had, like I said, so many opinions of what you people are going to be like. I walked in. First, I knocked on the door. It was an old, empty house. I knocked on the door, and somebody hollered, go around the back. And I didn't like the way he said it. I almost ran away. And I said, no, I got to go. I got to tell my wife I went. So I walked in the back door, and this guy that yelled at me, he come over, and he says, shook my hand. He says, my name's Lenny. And he says, are you new with us? I said, you're having a problem with booze. I said, yeah, my wife thinks so. I'm not sure. So he said, well, give this a try, kid. It really works. And this guy reeked of alcohol, you know? So now I knew I was in the right place, you know? I mean, this guy smelled right, you know? So that's the kind of guy you could trust, you know? So I sat at the meeting, and I used to say, alcoholic is a shaky little old man. I ain't no alcoholic. I was 31 years old. And the first guy that sat next to me was a shaky little old man. And one of the speakers said, if you know, get a sponsor. So I asked this guy, what's a sponsor? He says, I'll be your sponsor until you find somebody you want. And so I said, all right. So I heard three speakers that night anyway. So I identified with all three of them. One guy was in 43 mental institutions, and I was never in one, but I identified with his thinking. Another guy was down in Bowery for 9 years, living in the street. And I used to hang around the Bowery when I was a kid, because I could drink down there. But I never lived in the streets or anything like that, and I identified with his thinking. And I didn't even know what identify meant, but I found that out after I got to learn about the AA lingo. And a third guy was like me. He was a married guy with a family and started pushing his wife around too much, and he came to AA and got sober. And there are three perfect stories for me, because I identified so clear. I wanted it. I wanted AA. I wasn't really planning on stopping drinking. I was just going to stop until the heat was off, and then, you know, she'd forgive me. We'd live happily ever after, and I could go back to social drinking again, you know? So the shaky little old man, I seen him, they had meetings then. It was Monday and Friday, and that was a Monday. So I said, I'll see you Friday. So he said, if you need anything, call me. He didn't even have a phone. He had his sister's phone. I could call her, but she'd run over and get him and bring him back. And so I didn't want to bother him. You know, I was too good-natured for that. So Friday night, I come show up at the meeting. There's Shaky Bill there, and he says, how you doing? I said, all right. He said, how many meetings you make? I said, well, I'm here. I was there Monday, I'm here today. So he says, that ain't enough. So He says, I'm running a group in Pilgrim State Hospital. Long Island is a nuthouse capital of the world, you know. We got three of them right with, you know, within range for me. And plus, the North Park veterans had a nut ward, too. But so he said, I'll meet you over at Pilgrim State. And he told me Saturday, he said, I'll meet you there at 7 o'clock meetings. I'll meet you there. And he tells me how to get into the place. And being that I'm so smart that I didn't have to listen to him, I know, I'll just drive in. I say, where's the AA meeting? I mean, that's simple. So I go and everything's locked. All the buildings are locked. And man, this is a spooky looking place. So I go to this big building, big high doors. I pound on the door. And some guy comes to the door. It was the administration building. I said, where's the AA meeting? He says, which one? We have 7 of them here. So I said, I don't know. The guy even told me the name of the group was Duffy's Tavern, but I forgot that. I was so smart. So he said, I'll tell you the meeting. So the guy takes me upstairs to a meeting. It's in a locked ward. And he keeps locking doors behind me. When he locked me in, I think, who the hell's going to vouch for me? You know, they may think I belong here. You know, I was scared, really scared to death. I seen one woman, a black woman, Willie Mae, who I seen at my Babylon meeting, and maybe she'd remember me. You know, so I sit there shaking in my boots, and the meeting started, and then they had a break for coffee, and the door opens up, and a guy comes in with coffee and cake, and I went out. I went out the door. I was testing the waters to see if they'd let me out, and they did. So, I never went back to that place. I did go back there once later on. But I got indoctrinated into AA. I didn't get nothing out of that meeting, but I liked the discussion meeting, but I liked the speaker meetings better. I loved the people. They were the same people I drank with, you know? Same kind of people I drank with. So, I met my sponsor the following Sunday, because they held the anniversary on Sunday in a different place. So come to find out, I brought a guy with me. I was kind of dry up the world. He was my old drinking buddy. And I brought him to the meeting with me, and he knew my sponsor, you know. And he introduces me to him. And he didn't think he needed the program. So my sponsor, he's a real smart ass, and he says, you know, how you doing? How many meetings you making? Because my buddy Eddie was bragging about, hey, this guy has changed so dramatically, so drastically, it's like night and day. So Eddie said, oh, that's good. How many meetings you make? I said, well, it's my 4th one. How long you been in? About a week and a half. He said, that ain't enough. So I said, well, how many do you make? He said, oh, I go every night. He said, why don't you try it for 90 days and if you don't like it, we'll give you back all your misery, you know? So I didn't like this guy, but he had something I wanted. So come to find out, the next time I was with him, I was telling him that, you know, I'm a plumber, I'm in business. I hadn't worked in 4 months or 5 months, but I'm in business, and I give him my card. The business name was Clean Living Al's Plumbing, you know. And he looks at the card, he's, oh my God. He says, I met you in the Derby Bar about 6 months ago and you gave me a card. You know? He remembered the name. So we got to like each other after a while. But I was so wacky. I had no idea what AA was about. And he took me to a meeting one after. There were very few afternoon meetings. He said, I'll take you to a day meeting. I'm off tomorrow. So he took me to a meeting in Cold Springs Harbor. It was in a church. And it was in the woods. You had to drive through the woods, dodging trees and everything. I said, where the hell's this guy taking me? I don't know the guy. Can I trust him? You know, I'm thinking, shit, man, this guy's liable to rob me. You know, I had 35 cents in my pocket. I'm worrying about getting robbed. Then I think, well, maybe he's a pervert. You know, he's going to take advantage of me in the woods. I thought, oh, shit, I ain't had sex in so long. Maybe, how bad could it be? You know? So I think it was completely out of whack. But he was the one, the reason how he got me to go to meetings every night, I tell him, I don't believe you go every night. So he says, I go to Northport on Tuesday, I go to Islip on Tuesday. He started rattling off all the meetings he went to. And he gave me a meeting book. So I started going to these meetings to see if he was really there, because I didn't believe him, you know? And he was always there, you know? So then I started believing and I started listening to him. And he was the perfect sponsor for me. He was sober for 3.5 or 4 months, you know. And he had bounced around AA for a while, but didn't get it. And now he was really solid. And it seemed like what I was going through, he had just been through. So he seemed to have all the answers for me. And he had the right questions for me. He said, when I first came in my first amendment, he said, can you stay away from a drink for 1 day? I said, any jerk can stay away from a drink for 1 day. I've done it 1,000 times. He said, well, if you don't get anything from this meeting, remember what you just said. And tomorrow when you wake up, if you want to drink, remember what you said. You just stay away from it for a day and come to the meeting at night. And that got me on this 1 day at a time kick. And it really works. I got so I loved AA. I would rather go to AA than go on vacation or anything. I went on vacation one time. I was edgy the whole time I was there. It was the first vacation I ever had in my life. And I couldn't wait to get back, to get to my meetings. We were very active then. You know, we had a speaker meeting every week and a discussion meeting at our group. Every group had that. And so we had a sign up to speaker meetings, and after you had 90 days. So we were traveling and on 12-step calls. I was on a 12-step call my first week, second week in the program, the week I met my sponsor, and with him. And of course, I said, you know, what can I tell the guy? What can I do for the guy? He says, you're sober today, ain't you? He said, yeah. I said, you've been sober 2 weeks now? I said, yeah. He said, that's a hell of a lot more than he's got, you know? And I started realizing how lucky I was, because I really wanted it. So I got very active speaking and 12-step calls. I'll tell you about one 12-step call I had. Christmas Eve, I get a phone call from Intergroup, and they said, there's a guy called, he's in a drugstore in Babylon, and he's in Dates Pharmacy, that was the name of the place, and he wants help. And I thought, oh, Christmas Eve, I got 5 kids home, and a pregnant wife, she was pregnant because we got back together again. We split up and we got back together. And so I called this guy I was sponsoring. He lived in Babylon, I didn't. And I said, meet me at Dates Pharmacy. There's a guy that wants help. So I go in there, and there's nobody there. So I go to the pharmacist. I said, was there some drunk hanging around here? And he says, yeah, he just left a little while ago. I said, oh, shit, he called for help. And I don't know. He said, he went down that way. So we start walking down the street, and I see a police car making a U-turn coming back towards us. And my buddy says, I bet you he's in the cops got him. So jump in my car, and I turn around and go find the police. I knew where the police station was. I headed for the police station, and sure in the hell, there's the cop with this drunk in the back. And this guy was a real sick drunk. He threw up all over himself, and he was an older guy, and he was incoherent. So I run up, and the cop grabs his gun. He says, what do you want? And I says, did you just pick up that guy? He says, yeah, why? I said, well, I'm with AA, and he wanted help. And I came to try to help him. He says, you want him, take him. He took him to my car, puking off, you know. And so we took him to the nut house, because I didn't know, we didn't have all these halfway houses and all that stuff then. So I had to take him to the nut house. And they said, I brought him in. They said, you can't sign him in. He has to sign himself in. And the guy didn't even know his name, for God's sake. So the orderly or whatever he was, he says, I tell you what, I'll leave you here. You talk to him, maybe you can talk him into staying and signing the paper. So he had a pack of cigarettes in his pocket that said Duffy on it. And that's the second Duffy I might come to think of it. And there was no talking to him. He was out of it. So I just took the paper and I signed Joe Duffy and called the guy in, and they took him in. Next day I found out we went to visit him. That's what we used to do. And you put him in a nut house, you visit him. And he was out already. And the reason he had the cigarettes with the name Duffy on it, he just got out of Pilgrim State Hospital that morning. And he was in Central Islip Hospital this night. So they shipped him back to Pilgrim State. That's why he wasn't there. Anyway, that was my experience. I had a lot of experiences with 12-step calls. I had a woman. She was at the meeting. I knew her. I was in about 3 years then, at this time. And she said, Al, would you drive me home? I said, hell no. She was drunk. And I said, I ain't gonna drive you home. Get a woman to drive you home. And there was no women around, so I said, okay, so me and this guy, Joe Shapiro, took her, and another guy, Wild Willie. we figured, you know, her husband wasn't going to be too happy to see us. So we get her home, and she says, come in and talk, would you come in and talk to my husband? So we go in. She opens the door, she says, hey, Mario, I got some guys here that want to talk to you. This guy come out of the bedroom shaking, you know, they thought we were going to do a number on. And he says, what would you do if you went to work in the morning and you left your wife sitting on the couch with the baby and you come home at night and there's the baby with a shitty diaper on and she's passed out on the couch? What would you do? I said, I'd do the same thing you're doing. I'd throw her the hell out, you know. So she heard that and her ears perked up and she got sober after that. She found out, you know, the kind of friends she wanted weren't going to do her any good. But anyway, like I said, I got active. After 7 years in the program, me and my wife split. There was so much damage done in the beginning, there was no hope for us, you know? And we split, and I moved to Florida in 1973, and a couple of years after we split, 2 years after we split, I moved to Pompano Beach, and got very active with the groups down there. The same format, they had the same deal. And there was a lot of speaking. Speaking does me good. That's why I thank, what's his name? I got a good memory span. The reason I thank them for asking me to speak, because if you don't get nothing out of it, I do. I hear myself, and I remember what the hell I am. With my memory span, if I didn't go to meetings every day and I didn't speak once in a while to remind myself who I am and where I'd be, I'd forget. I'd forget. Yeah, and I'd think, hey, shit, I can drink. You know, I could probably drink now. But I know. I know positively, definitely, I can't drink. I did too many things against my own will when I was drinking, you know? And it owned me. It really owned me. I mentioned about cheap people. I hated people who drove Ramblers, you know? That was the first economy car. And they were cheap bastards. That's the only reason they drove me. And so one night I'm driving home from work. About I got off at 4:30, and it's about 2 in the morning. And I'm driving home, and who passes me but a Rambler? You know? Son of a bitch, I got a Chevy. He can't pass me, so I pass him. And he passes me again. And I tried to pass him again. He had more guts than I had. You know, he had more power in the car than I had. So I ran him off the road. I was on the parkway. And I left the scene of the accident, and that was the last time I got arrested. And I was facing losing my license, and I was facing a year in jail for leaving the scene of the accident, the cop told me. But you know, my bad youth, served me real good that time, because it wasn't the last time I got arrested. I knew how to talk to cops, because when you're a wise guy by nature, you get beat up a lot, you know, by the cops. So I learned how to talk to them. I was very polite, and this guy hadn't learned that. So he gave them a bad time for not catching me. I got home, but he got my tag number, and they picked me up a couple of hours later. They took me to the diner, bought me bacon and eggs and coffee and everything. Never mentioned drinking. Took me and locked me up for the night. And then he went to bat for me in court, telling the judge, I don't know if he was drinking or not, but the complainant was, you know. So everything got dropped. I got a $50 fine and some slap on the wrist and that. But one of my claims to fame, I was a tough guy, I thought, you know.
I'm just telling you what time it is, honey.
Oh, jeez. Oh. Sorry about that.
The War Department has to tell.
That's okay. We're enjoying it tonight.
Anyway. I never look at her. All right, well, I'll wind it up. Every problem I had in my life, after I was sober a while, I started realizing every problem I had in my life, I caused. Me and my booze. When I started trying to live according to the steps, the third step and so on, turning my life, my will, the care of the higher power, nothing bad ever happened to me. I went broke in business in Florida, and I thought it's the end of the world, you know. I had a real good business going, and I screwed it up with my character defects. I got a girlfriend, and, you know, I had a second wife, and a girlfriend, and all this kind of stuff. wasn't living the program, but I was still going to meetings and staying sober. And so I blew the business, and because I blew the business, I ended up with a job as a plumbing inspector. And because of that, I'm here. I got a pension. I worked 9 years and got a pension. Wow. The last thing in the world I ever wanted to be was a plumbing inspector. Against my will. You know, God's will always worked out the best for me. And my whole life. And the other night at a meeting, I had a revelation. We're talking about the 11th step, about, you know, prayer and meditation. Find out God's will for me. And it's very simple. I did have a Catholic education. I'm not religious at all, but we have 10 commandments. If you abide by them, you don't kill nobody, you don't steal, all them commandments. There's a few of them, I forgot a lot of them, but nothing bad will ever happen to you, you know? That's God's will. Anything else I do, if they're not against the 10 commandments, I do fine. Even when I make mistakes like having a girlfriend on the side, you know? I know it was wrong, but I somehow managed to justify it in my mind. And then that ended that marriage. I ended the marriage. And I met my Joni, the one who just trying to shut me up in the program. Best thing ever happened to me, to be married to an alcoholic, because I can't threaten her with nothing, because she can threaten me with the same crap, you know? So I used to say, I'll go get drunk, I'll show you, you know, never meaning it. But anyway, I'm very fortunate that the way I worked my program, it was still my self-will, run riot and everything else, but the meetings are where it's at. The fellowship of AA is the most important thing. I had so many friends in the program, and I learned how to treat people because of the program, so I had a lot of friends outside of the program, and I managed to stay sober with all my errors. I found out with these character defects we talk about, they don't go away. They stay there. They were always there. When I was being faithful to my wife, it was only because I couldn't do otherwise. I was always thinking. But they don't go away. You got to walk around them. It's like my sponsor one time told me that, and I forgot it. But he said, if you're a kleptomaniac, you stay out of department stores. Because if you go in there, you're going to steal, you know? And he was talking about going to the bars. So if you're going to go in a bar, you're going to drink. So you work around them. And so when I gave up all my character defects, including that one, life is so simple. It's so simple. It's so easy to live. I have no problem staying sober. And I have a good relationship with my higher power, even though, you know, I don't know him real good. I learned I don't have to believe everything. I just got to do it, what they tell me. I don't have to believe it's going to work. My wife, I gotta bring her into it. She was a Catholic, too. She's another recovering Catholic. And she believes in St. Anthony. When you lose something, you pray to St. Anthony, and he'll find it for you. And I had a hat, a fedora, that I used to wear every place. And this is just a couple of years ago. And I lost it. Couldn't find my hat. So I said, well, I guess I'm not going to buy another one. So about 3 weeks, she tells me, pray to St. Anthony. I said, come on. She says, try it. So I said, hey, Tony, find my hat, will you? So about 3 weeks later, we have a big dust storm. We live in New Mexico. Big dust storm. My hat blows up on my front porch. I have no idea where it came from. So now I talk to Anthony every time I lose something, and it always comes. I always find it, you know. So I still don't believe it, but I do it, you know. And that's the way I work my program. Anything I don't believe, I just try it. I do it, and I end up being a believer. So if there's anybody new, hey, go to meetings. That's the best part of AA, and you really learn how to live, and you're going to benefit more than you ever dreamed, on your wildest dream. That's all. Thank you for putting up with this one.
Cool. Well done. Thank you all.
That was very enjoyable. Anybody that wants to share with Al after the meeting, please? Okay, we are nearing 9 p.m. All right.